No doubt the top story this week at Lake Success is China's complaint to the UN against the Soviet Union. As you prepare your weekly memo, you find yourself recalling the voices of the two key figures in this story, Dr. T.F. Chiang of China.
The Soviet Union has given both direct and indirect, both moral and material support to the communist insurrection in China.
And Mr. Andrei Vyshinsky of the Soviet Union.
The statement of the representative of the Kuomintang regime is nothing but a slanderous attack against the Soviet Union.
Your first inkling of this important news development comes on Tuesday, when a sign goes up on the UN bulletin board, Dr. Chiang Press Conference at 2:30. You join the 150 other press and radio reporters converging on conference room number 12. In no time, the room is filled to overflowing. There, at the center of a long table, facing you, is a dark-haired, serious man. He's Ambassador T.F. Chiang, head of the Chinese delegation. Speaking deliberately, he tells the reporters China's official charges against the Soviet Union.
Threats to the political independence and territorial integrity of China and to the peace of the Far East resulting from Soviet violations of the Sino-Soviet Treaty of Friendship and Alliance of August 14, 1945, and from Soviet violations of the Charter of the United Nations.
As Dr. Chiang finishes, the questions come thick and fast from the correspondents who jammed the room. Something in the tone of their voices shows clearly that your colleagues tag this as page one news. And so with a final thank you, Dr. Chiang, they dash out of the room and head for their typewriters and microphones. By Thursday, a special meeting of the General Assembly is called to take up the Chinese request. Speaking to the delegates of all 59 nations, Dr. Chiang briefly explains the basis of his charge. He will go into greater detail, he says, when the political committee discusses the matter. A few minutes later, the foreign minister of the Soviet Union, Mr. Andrei Vyshinsky, finds fault with the general nature of the Chinese charge. How can I reply to the accusation when the facts are not put before me, says Mr. Vyshinsky. You record these moments in the conference room at Lake Success, where the white-haired Soviet spokesman makes his reply, and then Mr. Vyshinsky questions the motives behind the Chinese complaint, alleging that Dr. Chiang no longer speaks for the Chinese people. Since Mr. Vyshinsky spoke in Russian, the voice you will hear is that of the official UN interpreter as he follows the Russian address.
The statement of the representative of the Kuomintang regime is nothing but a slanderous attack against the Soviet Union. At the same time, however, you are slandering and libeling your own people, sir, which has turned away from your government, which has chased your government out of the greater part of its territory. And which, I am quite deeply convinced, does not consider you to be its representative, the Chinese people's representative here.
Mr. Vyshinsky continues with his own analysis of the real cause of China's problem. And once again, the interpreter.
This attempt to ascribe to the Soviet Union the success of the Chinese people in its struggle with the rotten or rotting regime, to ascribe this to the Soviet Union, I say, is absurd. It is a mere chemical process. Whatever rots falls apart. Whatever falls apart disappears. It dust comes to dust and ashes to ashes. Whatever the Chiang Kai-shek regime stood for in China could lead to nothing but disintegration, rotting, disappearance. And liberated from the yoke of these reactionary forces, the people's forces are now rearing their head, holding up high the flag of democracy and independence, and these new forces are the true representatives of their country and people.
To make his point, Mr. Vyshinsky turns to a dispatch which appeared this month in the New York Times.
In that dispatch, there was a statement by Senator Connolly, whom we all well know, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate. Senator Connolly of Texas was opposed to further assistance to the Kuomintang government And he referred to the head of that government, who, he said, beat it to Formosa, having put in his pocket $130 million in gold that belonged to China.
You notice how skillfully the UN interpreter catches the mood of the Soviet foreign minister. With a smile, Mr. Vyshinsky refers once again to the New York Times.
The New York Times writes, not without wit, that American equipment got so rapidly into the hands of the National Revolutionary Army that the Chinese communists called Chiang Kai-shek a quartermaster corps sergeant, who was quite efficient in supplying them.
But in spite of Russian opposition, the General Assembly agrees by an overwhelming majority to take up China's complaint against the Soviet Union. And now for a preview of China's case, the head of the Chinese delegation, Dr. T.F. Chiang, appears before our microphone for an exclusive interview. Dr. Chiang, in presenting the Chinese complaint before the United Nations, you've charged the Soviet Union with violating two international agreements. First, the Treaty of Friendship that was signed by China and Russia in 1945, and secondly, the United Nations Charter itself. Could you explain these charges, sir?
Mr. Hayward, I will answer your question to the point, but only briefly, because time does not allow a very lengthy answer. The Treaty of Friendship and Alliance between China and Russia was signed in fulfillment of the Yalta Agreement. The Yalta Agreement was the price paid for Soviet participation in the war against Japan. China paid the price. What price did China pay? China had to give Russia half a share in the port of Port Arthur. China had to give certain shipping facilities and war facilities in the port of Darien. China had to give control of half control over the trunk railway in Manchuria. In return for this big prize, China got two things. One, the Russians promised to give China support, moral and material. And that support, it was specifically stated, should be given to the central government of China.
That is the nationalist government.
That's the nationalist government, sir. In the second place, Russia promised to respect China's sovereignty and integrity, including sovereignty and its integrity in Manchuria, which includes the port of Darien. Now, instead of giving China economic assistance in the post-war period, as the treaty calls for, the Soviet army, after entering into Manchuria, removed a considerable part of the industrial equipment there. Instead of giving moral support, as well as aid in military supplies, in other material resources to the central government of China, as one of the agreement calls for, the Soviet Union has given both direct and indirect, both moral and material support to the communist insurrection in China. Instead of respecting China's sovereignty in Manchuria, which includes Darien, the Soviet Union has prevented the central government of China from using the port of Darien and from setting up an administration there. In violating these important provisions of the treaty, the Soviet Russia at the same time violated the fundamental principles of the Charter, which include respect for the sovereignty of neighbors and which includes non-interference in the domestic affairs of a neighboring state.
Dr. Chiang, will you be able to bring forth documentary evidence of these charges when the time comes?
Certainly. I shall bring forward evidence and proofs to substantiate my statement.
Dr. Chiang, Mr. Vyshinsky charged yesterday that by blaming the Soviet Union for the internal situation in China, you are attempting to conceal the failure and fiasco of the nationalist government. I'm quoting his words. Would you have any reply to that charge?
I'm not trying to shoulder all the trouble on Soviet Russia. That is not my intention at all. The Soviets have their share of responsibility. Now, he likes to talk about the corruption of my government. The Chinese government is not free from corruption. But we cannot judge one government by comparing with another government. We can only judge a government by comparing it with its predecessors. There is no question that the nationalist government of China today is a great improvement upon all its predecessors in the last two or three centuries. Furthermore, Mr. Hayward, I think foreign observers have failed to pay due attention to a very important fact. The fundamental problem in China is poverty. That poverty in China is old, it's wide, and it's deep. And that poverty has been intensified by 8 years of war and blockade by Japan. That really prepared the soil for communism. And that gave the communists the excuse, the opportunity to fool the people.
As a matter of fact, Dr. Chiang, Mr. Vyshinsky referred to a New York Times clipping yesterday reporting that Senator Connolly had accused Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek of absconding to Formosa with $130 million that actually belonged to the nationalist government in China. Would you have any answer to that charge?
Senator Connolly, like other great men, occasionally makes mistakes. This is one of them. The foreign exchange resources of the government are in all times deposited with the Central Bank of China. The Central Bank of China, as custodian of the government funds, decided to transfer the reserves from Shanghai to Formosa. And it is they are now in the vaults of the Formosa branch of the Central Bank of China. The government is spending that money. It is not the property of any individual. The mere removal from Shanghai to Formosa did not make it the property of a private individual. The central government, in balancing its budget, in meeting its foreign commitments, including China's membership fee in the United Nations, has to draw upon that fund and has been drawing upon that fund. There was no personal element to that transaction whatever.
I wonder, Dr. Chiang, if you could explain why you've submitted the Chinese complaint this week to the General Assembly and not to the Security Council.
One reason is obvious. The Security Council is inseparable from the veto. And we do not want to present this case and, after months of effort, to find ourselves an end met with the veto. In the second place, the General Assembly is the moral form of the whole world. A case as vital, important, and decisive for the future of China, we think, should be heard and judged by the entire body of the United Nations.
You thank Dr. Chiang for this exclusive preview of China's case against Russia. Each week, your UN reporter will interview the men who make the news on Memo from Lake Success.
You have been listening to Memo from Lake Success, an official program of the UN. Each week at this time, the Columbia Broadcasting System and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation present Memo from Lake Success, edited and produced by United Nations Radio. Portions of this program were transcribed.